today we're finishing up this four-part lesson series looking at intentional living, choosing how I'm going to live instead of just letting life happen to us. And one of those places where you have to really think about that is how you're going to react when life gets tough, because it's bound to happen. Pastor Ed has been talking about writing down our goals and where we'd like to be in 1, 2, and 5 years from now. He's been talking about making some goals to lead us into that future that we all dream of. And he's also been talking about deciding who we will be while we're moving forward. In other words, our values. One value that will come up over and over again is courage and integrity, especially when we encounter that worst-case scenario. Have you ever seen that book before, Worst Case Scenario? It describes what you should do if you ever encounter a worst-case scenario. This is what the book says you should do if you are ever attacked by an anaconda snake. Thankfully, we don't really have to worry about that here. But if you guys ever do some traveling, now you'll know. Okay, number one, if you're attacked by an anaconda snake, do not run. The snake is faster than you are. Number two, lie flat on the ground. Three, put your arms tight at your sides and your legs tight against one another. The snake will come and begin to nudge and climb over your body. Number five, do not panic. Six, after the snake has examined you, it will begin to swallow you from the feet end. Always from the feet end. Seven, the snake will now begin to suck your legs into its body. You must lie perfectly still. This will take a long time. Eight, when the snake has reached your knees, slowly and with as little movement as possible, reach down, take your knife, and very gently slide it into the side of the snake's mouth, between the edge of its mouth and your leg. Then suddenly rip upwards, severing the snake's head. Number nine, be sure your knife is sharp. And number 10, be sure you have your knife. I love that last one. Be sure you have your knife. Basically, today's lesson is all about making sure you're prepared. Let's watch this video. All right. So nobody likes to be forced to learn the hard way. That's not what today's lesson is about. But the idea behind worst-case scenarios is that you never know when they're coming. And if you want to survive them, you have to be ready. Today we're going to look at the story of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The story of Daniel and his friends is pretty much a story of them finding themselves in the worst-case scenario. And they didn't know what was going on. It was written to let the people of God know that even when things may seem like they're completely out of our control, God is still there with them in our worst-case scenario. If you were here last week, then you'll remember that Pastor Ed was talking about when people of God had been conquered and taken into captivity in Babylon, where they lived in exile. They were pretty much in the worst-case scenario. Most of them didn't really think how they should prepare themselves. They thought they wouldn't be in Babylon for long, but if you remember the lesson from last week, God told them to bloom where they were planted. So there were four guys who decided to do that, to bloom where they were planted, and to decide before they found themselves in another worst-case scenario how they would react when they got there. Out of all the people that were dragged to Babylon and forced to live in exile, the cream of the crop were chosen for the service of the king. If you know much about the Old Testament, you know that there were lots of things that the foreign kingdoms did in Israel that God was just not happy with and didn't like. He spent a lot of time training the people of Israel about the dangers of their way of life and warning them to stay away from it. Something that was a little easier to do if you were free and living in Israel than if you were living in captivity in Babylon under the rule of the king. But Daniel and his friends decided to be intentional about their lives, intentional and proactive. Look at what the Bible says in Daniel 1:8. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself. So let me tell you, there is a lot of power in making a decision before the worst case scenario happens. If you've already decided what you're going to do to a certain thing that happens, then you're already at an advantage. It's like getting attacked by an anaconda. If that ever somehow happens to any of you, you are at such an advantage than the people who didn't come to church today. Aren't you guys glad you came? Anyways, Daniel and his friends decide first thing that they're not going to do anything that violates their beliefs. And they already had a pretty good idea of what they might be forced to do under the rule of the king. But they still resolve that they wouldn't violate their integrity. And because of that, God blessed them with wisdom and power. Look at Daniel 1:17. God gave these four men knowledge and skill in both books and life. So let me tell you something. When people decide that they are going to live according to their integrity, to live the way they believe God is asking them to live, it's not easy, but God always blesses us for it. Today we're going to look at a couple of stories revolving around Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We're going to see what happens when people live according to their values and according to their integrity. And I'll just tell you right now, it's not always what you think. Now, even though we know about these stories, we don't often focus on the bad stuff that happens to them. The stories we tell a lot in church are all wrapped up in a bow where God is victorious and our lives are easy and miraculous. All our problems are solved and life goes the way we think it should. But nobody's life is like that, at least not all the time. So how do we handle life when it's not working out the way we'd like? This is the point of the book of Daniel. There's a lot of victory in this book, but there's also a lot of pain and trouble and life going wrong. But even in the midst of that, what we see is God has a plan. And when we decide in advance that we are going to live according to that plan, we are blessed for it. But if you were here last week, then you remember God's plans are not always about making our lives easy. Sometimes God's plans for us are about how to survive and thrive during the tough times. His plans are not always about life working out the way we'd like, and we see that in this book. So what can we learn from Daniel? The first thing we can learn today is I can't control my fate. Does this bother anybody else? I don't know about you, but I would love to be able to control my fate. At least, I think I would. I understand intellectually that God is a much better predictor of what is going to satisfy me than I am, but I still have this part of me way down deep that wants what I want when I want it. Adam and Eve tried to control their fate, and it didn't work out so well for them. In fact, it broke creation. But we still want to control our fate. Problem is, we can't. If Daniel and his friends didn't already know that, they know that now. Nation destroyed, temple torn down, captured and dragged to Babylon to live in exile, and now they're working for the king. And one night, the king of Babylon has this dream, and he was upset by it. So he calls all his wise men together to interpret the dream for him. And if they can do it, he's going to reward them handsomely. But if they can't, he says, I will chop you into pieces. What a great, great phrase. All right, so they say, okay, well, tell us your dream, king. And he's like, oh, no, if I just tell you the dream, you're going to make up something. You tell me what I dreamed and what it means. And they were like, we can't do that. Only the gods can do that. So they tell the king they can't do it, and the king decides to kill all of them. Look what it says in Daniel 2:13. Because of the king's decree, men were sent to find and kill Daniel and his friends. If you ever felt like you were having a bad week at work or school, like everything that could go wrong did go wrong, imagine how Daniel and his friends feel. If it's not one thing, it's another. And when what we realize as we read this book is that the true hope isn't only built in success stories. It's also built in the midst of life's worst circumstances. And what Daniel teaches us is that God is always at work in our lives, just not as fast as we'd always like and not always in the way we'd like. But if we've decided what our identity is going to be and who we are and how we will live, then God is able to work in our lives in ways we never knew were possible. Sometimes it's hard to see it, though, or have hope. We can look around at what's happening in our lives and think, there's no way that God can take what's going on in my life and make it into something good. But what I've learned in my life is that sometimes God is most powerfully at work when it seems like he's left Alaska and he's headed for much warmer climates. Daniel seems to understand that. Daniel doesn't know what to do, so he prays. What a brilliant decision. Sometimes we treat prayer as a last resort, but not Daniel. He treats prayer as his first line of defense. Daniel is faced with execution, and what he does is pray. And he tells his friends to pray too. And what we learn in this story is that there are things that are beyond all of our control. It's just interesting that King Nebuchadnezzar was one of the most powerful men in the world, but he couldn't control his own dreams. And Daniel was one of the most godly men in the world, and yet he still was at the king's mercy, and he couldn't control whether the king wanted to kill him or not. We can spend an awful lot of energy trying to control things that we can't control, and not much time working on the things that we have complete control over, our actions, our attitudes, thoughts, character, and our choices. God has called us to be people of integrity, but often we spend so much time trying to control uncontrollable circumstances that we lose sight of what's most important. So Daniel decides to live his life the way he's decided he'll live, even when he's faced with the things that are in his worst case scenario. He probably thinks it can't get any worse than this, but either way, he has already decided how he's going to live and what his life will be known for. So, and what his brand will be, if you will, as a man of prayer and a man of God. So God sends him the dream and the answer, and Daniel tells King Nebuchadnezzar the meaning of his dream, and this is what the king's response is in Daniel 2:48. Then the king said to Daniel, "Truly your God is the greatest of gods, the Lord over kings, a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal the secret." And then the king made Daniel the high priest of the Magi, the priesthood over Babylon. Daniel and his friends were intentional about how they would live their lives, even in their worst-case scenarios. And because of that, instead of just doing the easy thing or following the path of least resistance and allowing the things that happen to them dictate their paths and then eventually their destinations, they decide proactively how they will live, what values will drive them, and it becomes kind of a compass for them that will guide them through life in a sort of with a specific destination in mind. And it turns their life into a sort of living advertisement for God. In fact, it's almost like their lives become a sort of logo for God. When we look at Daniel, we get pointed to God. So we're going to play a little game. I'm going to show you guys a logo. It's going to pop up on the screen. When I show you the logo, I just want you to yell out what company it is. Okay? Some of them, the first ones are really easy, and it gets a little harder at the very end. So you guys can yell in church. It's totally fine, okay? So when I pop up a logo, you yell it out. The whole point of this, what I want you guys to see, is we see logos, and it points us to something, okay? We might not even, it's like literally an icon, and it makes us think of something else, okay? Same thing in our walk with Christ, okay? We see stuff, and it points us to different things. So when you see the logo, yell out what company it is, okay? We're going to start out with a really, really, really easy one. Here's the first one. Yeah, it's Car Safeway. Good job. Okay, that's the first one. Super easy. Fred Meyer, okay? We see it. It's a great logo, okay? Here's the second one.
Apple.
Okay, if you didn't know the company, if you just took a guess, you'd probably get it right, okay? But when we see this apple, when people say the word apple, I don't even think fruit anymore. I think computer, you know? So, okay, very good. Next one.
McDonald's.
Ah, love me some Big Macs. All right, very good. Next one.
Nike.
Okay, who'd have thought a little check mark makes you think of shoes and different things. Okay, awesome. Next one.
Chick-fil-A.
Yes. One day they will land in Alaska is my hope and dream. Okay, Chick-fil-A. Awesome. Next one. Oh, State Farm. All right. Very good. Like a good neighbor. All right. Very good. Next one. So, I want to make a point with this one. So when you see certain logos, you think certain things. Some of you see your favorite team. I see the enemy, and I see loser when I look at this logo, okay? I'm a Chicago Bears fan, so I can't like the Packers, you know? But, you know, I had to put that in there because I have so many friends that are Packer fans, you know? But it's all good. So that's what I'm saying. We see certain logos, you think certain things. Some people think their favorite team. Some people think enemy, okay? That's what I'm saying. The point with this, okay? Next one.
Walmart.
Okay, very good. Next one.
John Deere.
Wow, that was the loudest one. John Deere. Yeah. All right.
Ferrari.
Very good. Okay, next one. I think I heard it. Polaris. It is Polaris. Very good. Okay, the last one.
Lamborghini.
Very good. So, last night, the Saturday service, like, everybody was kind of like, and there's this little 5-year-old kid in the back, and he goes, "Lamborghini!" and his parents looked at him like, "How did you know that?" And I found out afterwards he's big into video games, and so he has a car game. So I told his mom he can use that excuse now. It helped him at church. So the point I wanted to make with that is what do people identify your life with? Okay, when people look at you, what do they see? Where does it point them to? Okay? When people look at me, I want them to see Jesus in my life. Okay? I want them to see that I love him. I want them to see that without me even having to tell them that I'm a Christian. So when you guys go throughout your week, okay, you're being watched all the time. Okay? When you go to a restaurant, okay, and you're talking to the waiter or the waitress or whatever, wherever you go, okay, at work, you're being watched, okay? And you're a logo for Christ, okay? And where is that pointing them to? Is it pointing them to Christ or is it pointing it away? When they look at your life, do they see love or do they see hate? Okay? So that's the point I wanted to make, that because when you look at these logos, they point us to a company, they point us to something. So what is it that's pointing you to Christ, and what are people seeing when they look at your life? I just want you guys to think about that. So what we also learned from Daniel and his friends is the number two thing we're going to touch on today is nobility isn't a matter of birth, it's a matter of choices. Here's what I mean by that. Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, are from the royal line of Judah. In the first chapter of Daniel, we learn that. What do you think of when you hear the word nobility? Probably the English royal family, right? In England, the thing that determines whether or not you're a noble depends entirely upon what family you're born into. Daniel and his friends are born into the nobility of Judah, but as far as God is concerned, nobility isn't really about what family you're born into. It's about whether or not we choose to bear a family resemblance to him, our father. And if you do, if you decide before the worst case scenario hits that you're going to live according to your values and be guided by the compass of integrity, then you will live a life of nobility. That's what these guys do. These guys realize that they can't control everything, and so they decide in advance that they will surrender their future to God no matter what comes. They've made that decision a long time ago, and that's what it was, a decision. Sometimes I think we get the idea that some people are made to be great men and women of faith, and the rest of us are just God's extras. But the thing that makes God's superstars stars is their choices. And they follow through with those choices no matter what is going on around them. That's what Daniel and his friends do. They surrender their lives and futures to God. One day, King Nebuchadnezzar, he has a statue made, and it's 90 feet tall. He commands that when the music plays, everyone will bow down and worship the statue. It's kind of like musical chairs in the old days, okay? He thinks everyone will do it. There's these three guys who don't, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Not sure where Daniel is during this time. It doesn't tell us. When the king finds out about it, he brings the guys in and tells them this in Daniel 3:15. I will give you one more chance to bow down and worship the statue I have made. But if you refuse, you will be thrown immediately into the blazing furnace. And then what God will be able to rescue you from my power? Now this falls into the category of a rhetorical question. No answer needed or expected. When I grew up, my parents' favorite rhetorical question was, do you want a spanking? And I never once answered that question by, you know, I was thinking about going outside and playing, but, you know, getting my butt smacked sounded like a better idea, actually. Okay, I never answered that. When the king asked what God can rescue you, he isn't looking for information, but that's exactly what he gets from these guys. Look at Daniel 3:16 through 18. We do not need to defend ourselves before you. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God whom we serve is able to save us. He will rescue us from your power, your majesty. This is one of the most amazing statements you'll ever read. They've decided in advance how they will live, even though this is a scary decision for them, and it's a tough decision. I mean, it's not easy, but it is simple. It requires tremendous courage, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist. They believe with all their heart that God is able to save them, and so do I. And so do a lot of you here today. The God we serve can reconcile broken marriages, and rescue people from horrible addictions, heal damaged bodies, forgive the darkest of sins, give supernatural wisdom, and turn people with pain and broken lives into a new creation. I've seen him do it. But Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they don't stop there. That's usually where we stop in church, though, right? We're trying to sell God to a skeptical world, so we don't really want to talk about the few times that God doesn't answer our prayers and do what we think he should. Sometimes relationships stay broken. Sometimes addicted people don't recover their lives. Sometimes sick people die. Sometimes we don't get what we ask for. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego understand that. They have been through some really lousy stuff already in their lives where God didn't answer the prayers that they wanted. So why would God do that? Because he always has a better plan for us. So as they stand before the king and tell him that they believe that their God is able to save them, they make a statement of devotion and faith that just blows you away. They say, we believe our God can save us. And then they say this in Daniel 3:18. But even if he doesn't, we will never serve your gods or worship the gold statue you have set up. So who are these guys? Where did they get this kind of faith from? Lots of time, modern day Christianity makes it seem like God is some like cosmic Santa Claus, and we follow him and everything will be double rainbows, puppy dogs, and butterflies. But it's not always that way, is it? Now, I'm not saying God isn't able, okay? I believe he is able to save his people. But what do we do when he doesn't? At least not in the way that we think he should. What do we do when we lose that job that we prayed we wouldn't lose? When the relationship that we prayed for turns toxic and destructive? When our finances don't work out? When our health fails? What do we do then? That's when deciding in advance what my identity will be and how I will respond to the worst case scenario really becomes crucial. That's what seems to separate the men and women of amazing faith who truly change the world from the people who don't. So the three make this statement, and you know what happens? Well, if you're like me, you're hoping the story ends a little bit like this.
Got room for one more if you still want to go to Aspen.
Where did you find that?
Some kid back in town. Traded the van for it, straight up. I can get 70 miles to the gallon on this hog.
You know, Lloyd, just when I think you couldn't possibly be any dumber, you go and do something like this. And totally redeem yourself!
Still wanna go to Aspen?
Oh yeah! Okay, let's go, buddy!
Lloyd, no, west! Go west, boy!
That's what you call a dramatic surprise, right? You thought Harry would be mad at Lloyd when he traded their doggy van, if you've seen the movie, for that stupid little scooter. But surprise, Harry is blown away by Lloyd's ingenuity. It'd be awesome if that's how the king responds, wouldn't it? But unfortunately, it's not how he responds at all. He flips out. He stokes the fire even hotter, and he throws him in. But this time when he does, something truly miraculous happens. He has the three young men thrown in the fire, and it's so hot that the people who throw him in the fire die because of how hot it is. And then this happens in Daniel 3, 24 through 25. Didn't we tie up three men and throw them into the furnace? Yes, your majesty, we certainly did, they replied. Look, Nebuchadnezzar shouted, I see four men, unbound, walking around in the fire unharmed, and the fourth looks like a god. Have you ever wondered who that fourth guy was? The one who, because he was there in the midst of the greatest trouble of their lives, they were miraculously saved. I believe he's always with us, even when we can't see him. But maybe in the absolute toughest moments of our lives, we get a glimpse of who we have the privilege of walking through this life with, if we choose to. The guy who turns crucifixions into resurrections. The guy who transforms our pain and makes something beautiful out of it. So the king calls him out of the furnace, and he says this in Daniel 3, 28 through 29. Praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel to rescue his servants who trusted in him. There is no other God who can rescue like this. Isn't that cool? Don't you just love stories like that? Wouldn't you love to experience this kind of rescue in your own life? To have people look at your life and say, wow, because of the life you lived, I think God's awesome too. But not all stories end that way, do they? Not all of Daniel's stories ended that way either. Otherwise, he never would have been in Babylon in the first place. That's something that if we don't understand, it'll shake our faith when things don't go quite obviously, is obviously miraculous in our own stories. Have you ever prayed for something and you didn't get what you asked for? Yeah, me too. But see, here's the thing. I can just guarantee you that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego wanted to be delivered from their furnace, but God decides to show up and deliver them in their furnace. Even to this day, God still meets people in their furnaces, in places that look frightening because they are frightening, dangerous because they are dangerous, and painful because they are painful. See, it turns out that where Jesus is in the furnace. And even though the furnace may look like a bad bet from our limited perspective, from an eternal perspective, it's the safest place of all. So how about you? How will you go through life? Will you just let life happen to you? Or will you live your life intentionally in 2016? Will you decide right now who you want to be and then live that way, letting your integrity and values be the compass that guides you? If you do that, then even when the worst case scenario presents itself, you'll know what to do and which way to go. And remember, as you go throughout this week, guys, you're a logo for Christ, and people are always watching us. And what do you want them to see? The furnace looks scary, but our God is able to save us. Let's pray. Dear Jesus, I thank you for today. I thank you for all the people coming this morning. And I just pray to be with everybody as they go throughout their week. I pray that they remember that they're a logo for you, and people are always watching us. And I pray that we imitate you and we show people Christ when they look at our lives. It's always tough. We're not perfect at it, but I pray you just help us get better day after day. In Jesus' name, amen.